For those who follow me on a weekly basis, I'll mention this. I've already done the first quarter of this show, and it had to do with air pollution and its effects on us. There was too much to do in one quarter, so I'm going to go and finish that up on this quarter of the show. Now, I've made it, so I hope that if you only catch this one and don't get the first, you'll still get a shot at what I'm talking about. And likewise, for you follow through, this will be a follow along for the first part of this week's show. So I started the first quarter of it more talking about the human cost of pollution. But now let's talk about the environment, because it also suffers. Acid rain formed by nitrous oxides and sodium oxides released into the atmosphere dissolve in rainwater, leads to acidification of soils and water bodies. And don't forget, our whole ocean is getting more acidic, making them unsuitable for some wildlife already, and it's growing. The nitrous oxide dissolved in the water can also cause what they call eutrophication, resulting in excessive nutrients and stimulating algae blooms. We've had that this year in Florida. It's happened more and more often. And they deplete the entire source of oxygen in the water, and a number of animals die. Like humans, both animals and plants are also susceptible to the health impacts of prolonged exposure to air pollution, making them much more sensitive to other environmental stresses. Combined with habitat loss and climate change, this accentuates the biodiversity loss that we are seeing now on a global scale. I'll throw a little factoid in here. Those of low-income backgrounds and ethnic minorities always suffer from the most exposure. And a study from the University of Leeds in England back in 2015 showed that about 85% of people living in areas with illegal levels of nitrous oxide were inevitably always living within the most heavily urbanized towns and cities, not just in the third world, but even in our country. It's obvious, but I should say, air pollution is intrinsically linked to climate change, such that policies tackling one issue often go hand in hand with the other. Let's use some facts from the United Kingdom as a case in point. The UK government has begun with restrictions on transport they call clean air zones, CAZs, and have set up, the biggest one I know of is actually in the city of London, but there are others, with charges for those who want to drive certain petrol and diesel-powered vehicles within those zones. More cities are set to implement these CAZs. We're even looking at them here in our country. But there has been resistance from some city councils. For example, in England again, the Greater Manchester area argued that the scheme would be too much of a financial burden and would still not bring air pollution levels into compliance with the current guidelines. One major move towards electric-powered vehicles, especially, this is a good week to talk about that, thanks to Biden, and put in some, selling some really good long-term rules and regulations that run into the year 2030 or 2035, looks like 2030, the government aims to end the sale of gas and diesel engines, working towards meeting its net zero target by 2050. Now, we've not enacted that in our country yet. However, as is highlighted in the reports I'm using, obviously totally or super reduced tailpipe emissions. The particulates, which are the greatest threat, remember that, in the big cities, tailpipe emissions are the greatest threat to human life, but they will still be produced by things that we haven't learned to overcome yet. We know how, but it's too expensive, including brake pads. And for goodness gracious, in the wear of the tires, even puts particulate matter into the air. And of course, the old question comes up, because many people also question whether the infrastructure as it is, if we don't jump on it, is it in place for supporting a transport sector dominated by electric vehicles? And whether the environment cost of manufacturing weighs out the reduction emissions overall on the road. And no, it does not. It's definitely an advantage to still be using electric cars. All the papers I can find, most of the available literature at least, suggest policymaking is probably the best way to tackle this issue. Stronger policies which concentrate on transport and reduction of fossil fuels, as well as the contribution of agricultural waste, which you've got to get more efficient with, and that kind of waste management and consumerism to air pollution, require what I would call an integrated approach across all the sectors at once. However, I should also mention here, though, so far the government's failure on a national level suggests that creating additional policies just might not be enough. Air pollution is often seen as a local issue. It is, but it's also international. Individual governments implement their own policies, and often the government only encourages, not directs, local authorities to put in place measures such as these CAZ, central zones that they have in Europe, that I think we should use to help reduce local air pollution problems that the smaller individual towns and thems either can't or at least won't implement. I hate it when big government tells small government what to do, but this is soon not going to be just an obligation, but a requirement if we're going to really keep this place as comfortable to live in as we've been used to for thousands of years. Let me give you sort of an illustration. It's pretty easy to follow. The nature of air pollution means that its issue spans across borders, folks. It doesn't care what the border is. It makes sense. Back in the 70s, Sweden, backed by other Scandinavian countries, presented evidence to the European Union that the majority of sulfur dioxide contaminating their air was from highly industrialized countries, including United Kingdom, France, and Germany. This spurred international collaboration with policies implemented to restrict the use of fuels with high sulfur content and reduce the burning of coal in power plants. Incidentally, resulting in a decrease of emissions by 98% from now since 1970. It helped to really reduce the problem, folks. So I think here you got to think about this. It is likely that without a global effort, everybody's got to be on board, folks, actions in our place, North America, Europe, and East Asia even, to reduce air pollution will be counteracted by continuing increases in pollution, if no other place, in what we call the global south, which is not reacted like Europe and the rest of the world. To me, the message is clear. Without decisive action, air pollution will continue to threaten lives on a national and a global scale. Raising public awareness of the dangers in every breath we take is actually the key to adding more voices to drive the government to act now. Now, not in 5 years or 3 years or 8 years. We've waited long enough. We've got to do it now. And here, thank goodness, I try not to be political, but just this move in the last week or so by the Biden administration, love it or hate it, and it's going to put some stress in some places. Folks, it's got to happen. I always use this as a really bad story, but believe it or not, when automobiles came into existence, there was a true resistance by a number of people in the public that thought they were terrible for the earth, and in some ways they were more right than we knew in the past as far as pollution and noise, and they wanted to stick to the horse and buggy, folks, and it took a while. There were places out west where they were still not in active rules, I wanted to use, for the right-of-way of roads with horses and let's say the Model T, that they didn't want to change the laws. They still, for many, many years, the horse actually had legal right-of-way, which kind of made sense. But it's a changing world, and where are horses today? I love them. I've had more than a dozen or so myself. But we are going to move on. We've got to move on to the next level of transportation. We've got to move on to the next level of now knowing what we're doing to the earth. We're going to do something to do our part. you know, LED you put in, and every piece of trash you don't throw that's especially plastic or something that goes into the oceans. That all counts. We all have to do our small part of what needs to be done to keep this place as civilized and as livable as we possibly can. Okay, I'll get off my soapbox. It's just with the new stuff going on, everything, my brain gets kind of stuck on the fact that we've helped. We're moving in the direction that is correct, but not as fast as we need to. So let's move on to some lighter subjects. Well, actually, maybe not so much lighter. It's in the same vein, but I think it's something that people need to start thinking about. I already have, and I'll give you my answer. One reason many people are really hesitant about switching to an electric car is what we call range anxiety, the fear that the car's battery will die on them in the middle of a trip somewhere. And it's pretty much the same thing as it's like running out of gas. I mean, we be sure and fill up the gas, but somehow it seems to be a little bit more dangerous to some people. Perhaps this was true when charging stations were few and far between, and electric cars could only go a few miles on a charge. But these days, the average electric car exceeds 200 miles, some 300, and there's a car, at least one I read about, Riven, I can't remember the name, that goes 500 miles on a charge, and that's what's coming. And not to mention, there are now charging stations all over the place. A big difference between gas cars and electric, though, that most people don't think about is you can charge your car every night at home. Okay, you just start out every day with what we would call a full tank of gas. With an electric car, there's a really little reason to use up all nearly all your charge unless you're really making a long trip. The truth is, in a large study, most people in the United States don't drive all that much at all on any average day. The United States average driver of the whole group, folks, is about 39 miles a day. In Europe, it's even considerably less than that. Yes, there are some people who drive 200 miles a day, but believe me, in numbers, they're few and far between. Interesting. Since I loved Australia when I was there, I love it. I'm going to go back. Remote and regional Australia is a place where distances between essential services can be very large. But a new study from Australia by the Australian National University found that even there, under those, I call them trying conditions, and believe me, it is a long distance sometimes, the vast majority of residents, over 90%, they claim about 93%, go about their business even with the lower range electric vehicles available on the market without having to recharge en route. 93% of the time, it's not necessary. I gotta admit, electric cars may not be practical for some drivers, but for most of us, they're already a great choice and they're getting better. Thanks for staying tuned to Organic Matters.